My name is Paul Hoskison, and I'm representing the Neil A. Maxwell Institute for Religious Scholarship here this evening. We are one of the sponsors of this lecture series, along with Religious Education at BYU and the library here. We want to welcome you all here to this lecture. We have several more to go before the lecture series is finished, but we have a real treat tonight in being able to listen to Alex Nibley. Some people, I'm told, have known him as Charles when he was younger, and various other names. Did they call you other names besides Charles and Alex?
So many.
His sister says so many, yes. He's the fifth of eight children in the family, the youngest son of Hugh Nibley. He graduated from Provo High School, served in the Tokyo North Mission, got his Bachelor of Arts degree in communication from the University of Utah, and his Master of Arts from the American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco. He freelances now in writing and media production, and is an adjunct professor at UVU in film production. If you've seen that wonderful movie celebrating Brother Nibley's life called Faith of an Observer, he played a huge role in that, helped with the writing and the directing and the producing, and you will see his name in one place on the credits. We're grateful that he got involved in that. He's married to Jana Lee. They have five children and two grandchildren. We're delighted to hear now from Alex. I'm hoping that he'll tell us some things we don't know. Alex.
Okay, yeah, to clear the record, yes, I am Charles and I am Alex. We're going over that with Ken Karcher, my old scoutmaster. It still confuses my mother. I switched to using my middle name on an airplane going to San Francisco at the age of 18. Somewhere over Nevada, I ceased being Charles and became Alex. It's a name my parents gave me, so I saw no problem in using it, but my mother still objects. Also, Paul said that I graduated from high school. He asked me where I went to high school. I said Provo High School. We parted company in 1974, and I eventually did get a bachelor's degree and some other things, but to say I'm a graduate of Provo High School isn't strictly true. That's a story that involves Hugh Nibley that we probably won't get into tonight, but it was an interesting story. My topic is Hugh Nibley's career from graduate school to BYU. And to begin with, I have to give a disclaimer. This is no one else's water, is it? This is...
We all had some, but you...
Okay. For those of you who are fans and admirers of Hugh Nibley as a scholar, I have to state up front that I am not an expert on Hugh Nibley as a scholar. It's not an aspect of his personality and his career that I know that much about. Probably many people here know more about him as a scholar than I do. There are others who have the intellect and the inclination and the interest to cover that topic much better than I. And I would certainly recommend you to Boyd Peterson, my brother-in-law's biography of Dad, who has very well researched that and writes about it very well. The second thing I want to say is that I'm going to cover that topic, but I also want to cover it in light of the conversations and particularly the interviews that I had with Hugh Nibley over many years. In the course of writing the book that I wrote, Sergeant Nibley, PhD, Memories of an Unlikely Screaming Eagle, I had the opportunity to interview him many times on camera, sometimes with a tape recorder, and sometimes just in private conversation. But I think I can safely say that on the subject of his war years, I've had more conversations with him than anybody. And when you say the topic is Hugh Nibley from graduate school to BYU, there's a great gaping ellipsis in the middle of that. The statement graduate school to BYU seems to project a smooth academic career going from one academic institution into another one. But of course, the years between graduate school and BYU were an entirely different kind of education. The non-academic education of Hugh Nibley, hence the education of Hugh Nibley that I find interesting. Because as Hugh Nibley went to war, he knew everything about it except what it was like. And so he was a little bit different kind of warrior. And finally tonight, I want to try to give you a few stories that maybe you haven't heard before. And maybe you think everybody's got a Hugh Nibley story. And the family policy is that we confirm all rumors. So everything you've heard is true, all of it. The one about him showing up to class in his pajamas I find particularly marvelous, since it would be the only time I think he's ever appeared in pajamas. But they're out there, okay? I'll give you a brief summary of his war experiences. And again, I would refer you to the book that I wrote if you want to go deeper into it. But in brief, there's a prologue to his war years that begins with his missionary experience. 17 years old, he was called as a missionary to Germany, where he went and served in Bavaria and other places in southern Germany, which at the time was the same place where Nazism, National Socialism, was experiencing its foment and its rise. Not only was he out on the same street corners passing out handbills along with the National Socialists, he also gained during his mission a great appreciation for German culture and a great love for German culture. And he actually wanted to go back to Germany to study in the great universities of Germany, and in that great intellectual tradition, which he, and of course the Germans themselves, considered the foundation of all Western civilization, art, and science. He went back to America after he went to through an undergraduate program, and then he went to graduate school at Berkeley. And again, I'd refer you to Boyd, who writes better about that than I can. On completing his doctorate degree at Berkeley, he went to teach at Claremont College. This was in 1938. He was at Berkeley from 1934 to 1938. When he was at Berkeley, he made one of the great friendships of his life, a man named Paul Springer, who was philosophically very divergent from him, very different. Paul Springer's background was Prussian, and he had a certain militaristic streak. And this, of course, was at a time when there was not a clear consensus in the United States as to whose side we ought to be on in the conflicts in Germany. That's very easy for us to forget now, because the term Nazi is now so completely vilified in our minds and raised to a level of, you know, absolute evil, that we forget that there was a time in America where there was considerable doubt and considerable debate about which side we should be on. And Dad and Paul Springer engaged in these debates very vigorously, and they loved it. And they continued debating up until the 1980s. When Dad went to Claremont, Dad was more left-leaning, Paul was very right-leaning, and they continued to trade these letters back and forth. Dad at one point became engaged to a Nazi sympathizer whose family was in Germany, were in tight with the the Third Reich, and Dad, she was a German modern dancer, and had that marriage ever happened, we'd be having a very different conversation right now if we had any conversation at all. That fell apart, probably to my benefit at least. And then Pearl Harbor happened, and all of a sudden everything became clear. And now Dad had been through several years of ROTC in high school, but he saw the handwriting on the wall for him at Claremont College. As the president told him, or the new president that came in when the president that he admired very much, President Story, died, the gentleman told him, "You are not one of us," meaning you're a Mormon. And he saw the handwriting on the wall, knew he was going to have to go somewhere. He was 32 years old, a PhD, a classic scholar, who had read most of the books in the Berkeley Library. And so he did the obvious thing and went out and enlisted as a buck private in the Army. They sent him to weather school, where he trained as a weatherman. That didn't last long before they picked up on his language abilities and put him into the intelligence service. That time there had not been an organized intelligence service for the entire U.S. military at that time. There's no such thing as the CIA or a centralized intelligence gathering force for the entire country. They were beginning to form that at a place called Camp Ritchie, where they threw Dad along with all kinds of crazy intellectuals and European immigrants, most of them Jews. And it was in that crazy soup that Dad was trained in intelligence. He was placed in an elite group called an Order of Battle Team. They were three-man teams, the smallest units in the Army. And he was sent over to England, figured he would be very safe with his highly trained, intelligent group of intellectuals analyzing German order of battle. He figured he'd be very safe right up until they announced that his group would be attached to the 101st Airborne Division and would be among the first to land in Normandy. So he trained to go in to Normandy in the glider attack. Because he was the intelligence master sergeant with the headquarters company for the headquarters company of the 101st Airborne Division, his seat was the number two seat in the number one glider that was to land. Well, a few days before the invasion, General Pratt, who was the assistant division commander, had been begging General Taylor to allow him to go in with the troops in the attack and go in with the glider landing. So they rearranged things, and General Pratt was given the number two seat in the number one glider. And Dad was reassigned just a few days before, after doing all the glider training, he was reassigned to go in the sea invasion instead. General Pratt, sitting in his seat, was killed in the crash. And Dad instead went drove a Jeep onto the beach at Utah Beach on D-Day. He later on did get to go on a glider attack into Holland, where he participated in the event known as Operation Market Garden. You may know it as the Bridge Too Far incident. It's interesting, when you research World War II, you'll find lots and lots of books about the Battle of the Bulge. You'll find lots and lots of books about the Battle of Normandy. You won't find a lot of books about the Battle of Holland, because it's a little bit embarrassing. It's not the happiest story from World War II. Now, I got these stories out of Dad over a period of many years, interviewing him, nagging him, and annoying him like crazy. I also had all his old letters that he had written to Paul Springer which were very valuable. I had letters that Boyd had accumulated between him and his mother at the time, and I had some diaries that he kept during the war. And then I also had lots of other accounts of World War II that were written by people who were in kind of the same place at the same time. And I had to cobble all this stuff together to try to form some kind of picture of what actually happened. There were a lot of times where Dad's memory was wrong, in little things, the way, you know, you would expect them to be wrong. He would tell me that something that happened at Normandy, I would look at the dates and figure things out and say, oh, you know what, that really had to have happened in Holland, could not have happened in Normandy, things like that. But he never told war stories with the big, grandiose kind of war storytelling. And I want to give you an example of that. I have here diary entries from when he was at Market Garden, when they were in a little town, a little village called Vergel in Holland. And he writes, September 20th, 1944, a sticky time. German tanks turning up everywhere. Our line is very thin in the 327, meaning the 327th Glider Infantry Regiment. September 21st, we forage for eggs in farms. Germans trying a big attack on our castle, much shelling and small arms fire all about. December 25th, the road's still cut, we're being heavily shelled, small arms fire very close on all sides. September 26th, what a night. Much air activity during the day, work with the PWs, prisoners of war. A lot of running around. So what he calls a sticky time, that's about as dramatic as you'll get in his descriptions of a battle, okay? I'm going to read to you here another account of someone who was in Vegel who could not have been more than a couple of hundred yards away from Hugh Nibley at the most. So he calls it a sticky time. This is how Robert Bowen describes it. As we neared Vegel, the sound of a major battle greeted us. We rushed into town among screaming shell bursts which rocked the ground under us, unloading and taking cover on a street of row houses in doorways or alleys. The artillery fire was deafening, as bad or worse than in Normandy. Several houses in the town were aflame, and a great pall of smoke was gathering above. The shells were falling fast and close, no more than 100 yards away. Startled, we huddled against the buildings, waiting for a shell to drop in our midst. It was one of the most terrifying moments of my life. I crouched in the foxhole, watching the German shell fire tear Vegel to pieces, fascinated in a morbid way by the brilliant shell bursts, great palls of smoke, and the raging fires as houses burned. There were people in there. Dutch civilians, American and British troops, paying the price for liberation. I thought about our price so far, the deaths of Omelia and Mazur, both young and eager. Omelia had been reading his Catholic prayer book minutes before he had been blown apart. It made me wonder, was it a failed answer to his prayers or a belief in nonsense? I couldn't get it out of my mind as I watched the city burning. This put a lot of, there are a lot of accounts like this that you can find, but the most, like I say, you're ever going to get out of Hugh Nibley was, it was a sticky time. Reading the descriptions of other people, of what was going on, taught me a lot about what he must have experienced. There was a sad day for him a few months later when in the town of Mourmelon-le-Grand in France, it was December 17th when word came through that the Germans had broken through the Ardennes woods and were coming through Luxembourg, Belgium. And the 101st was rousted out and sent to the battle. On that day, Hugh Nibley was separated from the 101st Airborne and sent to work with the British intelligence. The reason being that there were a lot of fifth columnists, there were Germans wearing American uniforms and speaking English going around trying to cause confusion and trouble. And so Dad was reassigned to go and focus on finding those guys and dealing with them. He wrote with sadness about watching the 101st drive away without him. Now, you'll hear him talk in very disparaging tones sometimes about the military and the men that were in it and about the foolishness of the entire operation. But believe me, I got to the point where I saw hints of nostalgia and also real admiration for the people that he served with. And he felt sad to be separated from the 101st. And to the end of his military service, it was the Screaming Eagle that he wore on his fatigue jacket. But it was on that day that the 101st was, of course, sent to the town of Bastogne, where they were surrounded. And there was a horrific battle. And very possible that Dad may not have survived that if he had been sent there. Several times during his career in that order of battle unit, the other two members of the team were killed or wounded, and he was left the only member of the team operating alone. After that, it was a steamroller as the American Army went through and destroyed Germany, which was a great, you know, if you watch the movies, a great moment of triumph. And for Hugh Nibley, a great moment of sadness as he watched the destruction of a civilization that he admired so much and the people that he had preached to. I remember him telling me once that going door to door with a squad of soldiers and a rifle is much easier than going door to door trying to persuade people to change their lives. The rifle was much more persuasive. And after the war, he went back to his favorite place on earth, to Zion National Park, tried to go back to LA. He couldn't stand it there. He got a car, he borrowed a car, drove up to Hurricane, rented a room, and he walked through Zion for several weeks to cleanse himself from the war. I asked him once, as he was speaking in very disparaging terms about, you know, the silliness of all things military, and I said, "Dad, did you ever see real heroism? Did you ever see heroism that you really admired?" And he said, "Yes, I did. When you take a 17-year-old Austrian kid and you interrogate him." He says, "You can take the SS guys and they'll break in a minute. They'll tell you more stuff than you want to know. You'll have to try to get them to shut up because they'll keep talking to you. But you take some 17-year-old Austrian kid who's just off the farm and doesn't know Hitler from a hole in the ground, and he says, 'You can take me out and shoot me, but I took an oath and I'm not going to tell you anything.'" He said, "That's true heroism." I found that interesting to be that in, you know, having served with some of the most decorated and biggest heroes that we know of in American military history, that was his example of great heroism in war. I'm going to tell you a couple of things I left out of this book in the editing process. One thing that happened when I started reading his early letters was that I found some stuff I didn't want to find. Not just the stuff about being engaged to a Nazi. He had written some letters to Paul Paul Springer. And the letters that they wrote were very intellectual and very caustic and very, it had that razor wit of Hugh Nibley, you know. That was not always a kind wit. And he had some stuff in there that was, by our standards today, certainly racist, and some of it strongly anti-Semitic. One of them was a story where he joked about Joseph Goebbels sending someone to find out his genealogy in Copenhagen. And when he went to the town hall in Copenhagen, the man who worked there, whom Dad knew, said he was grieved to tell him that he would have to research his genealogy in the synagogue. Dad found that very funny, and he joked about the Jews and said at one point, "Don't ever accuse me of being one." Well, of course, the joke was on him because he knew all along that his own great-grandfather was a Jew, the first Jew to convert to Mormonism, first Jew in the Utah Territory, first dentist in the Utah Territory, made Brigham Young's dentures. And Dad knew that. And my first thought when I came upon these letters was to say, well, I can't publish that. And then the second thought immediately after that was, if I feel that strongly about it, I've got to publish them. Eventually, I ended up with, so the first draft of the book I did, I put a lot of that stuff in and let it show in all its ugliness. And I read him that version of the manuscript, and he said, well, you can't publish that. And I talked to my mom, and it was mom who talked to him and said, you know, Hugh, that's part of your life, and, you know, you have to put it out there. And he agreed to let that version of the story be told. I actually cut it back a lot because I thought it was way out of proportion. As I read the manuscript over, it was out of proportion. First of all, because that was very much an American attitude at that time. That doesn't excuse it, but it was much more prevalent. And in the light of our current day, it looks much different than it would have looked back then. And but I did want to put that in there because I thought it was significant. So I reduced it a lot, and hopefully I came up with something that was somewhat in proportion. I do think it was an important part of his story, because after he went through the war, was trained with all those Jews, and then was put in teams with all those Jews, and watched all those Jews die and get wounded one after another, and then when he went to Dachau and saw what was there and what the great race, you know, the great country of Germany had done to people who were really his forebears, it changed him. And he raised me to believe that I must be about 98% Jewish, although in reality I'm probably about a 32nd Jewish. But when I took my little daughter in to him when he was on his deathbed, and I took little Isabella in there, and he pointed and says, "That baby is a Jew." And he meant it as a compliment. This is one of the reasons that I believe that the war was the greatest educational experience of Hugh Nibley's life, because it educated him not as an academic, but as a human being. Like I say, before he went into battle, his assignment with the 101st Airborne was to teach all the officers history of warfare and history of German warfare and German strategy and tactics. And he did his homework, and he came in with these lectures, and all the officers had to sit there and listen to this sergeant lecture them. And as I say, he knew everything about war except what it was like. And anybody who's been there, and I have not, which is one of the things that really gave me pause in writing a book about warfare, is that anybody who has spent 10 minutes in combat knows more than somebody who has a PhD in book learning about warfare. One other thing, I'll give you another example of something I left out of the book. There were a few times Dad had told the story. He told it to me, and he had told it in public, and it's out there on the public record in some places. He talks about this guy, Colonel Cole, who he says was a crazy hothead and led one of the only bayonet charges ever conducted in World War II. And then he said he got crazy drunk, took one company of men when they were in Holland, and decided he was going to go over with a company of men and take the town of Sertogenbosch. And he was fond of talking about what a crazy guy this Colonel Cole was. Well, I don't know. Colonel Cole may have been a hothead. He may have been a drinker. I don't know. But there's a lot I have found out about Colonel Cole after that. First of all, the bayonet charge that he led was probably saved an enormous amount of lives. It was done under extreme duress, and he was exposing himself to fire, picking people up out of the ditches and saying, don't stay here, you're going to die, run, charge, you have to do it, because it's the only way we're going to get out of here alive, although many of them died in the process. He was awarded the Medal of Honor for leading that, what Hugh Nibley called a crazy charge. Well, that's not why I left it out, because you can be a hero, a certifiable real hero, and still be a jerk, right? We know that's a possibility. But then it was the story of the death of Colonel Cole that I decided, and I went to Dad and told him I was going to remove that story, because I read several different eyewitness accounts of the death of Colonel Cole. And nobody said he was drunk. He was certainly not leading a company of men off to take the town of Sertogenbosch. He was in a field, and he was cut down by a sniper as they were trying to help some other men who had been hit by snipers. I attribute it to an error in his memory, that he may have gotten some events confused, he may have gotten different people confused. But I said, Dad, you know, this disagrees so much with the eyewitness accounts I've read that I don't think it's fair to Colonel Cole, and I don't think it's fair to his family to say that he died as a drunken fool. And he agreed with me, and we took that story out. Something that I think maybe people don't understand about Hugh Nibley is how much he valued disagreement. And this is a subject on which I can speak with some authority, because I probably disagreed with him more vehemently and more often than anybody except probably my mom. I had more headbutting with Hugh Nibley probably than anybody else. I remember well the first time. I told Mom that I was resigning from Family Home Evening. I didn't want to go anymore. Well, our Family Home Evening consisted of a lot of foreign athletes coming over to sit at the feet of Hugh Nibley while he talked about whatever he'd been writing that week and proofread. Basically, he'd proofread and read his stuff out loud, and you know, a lot of students and these pilgrims would make pilgrimages to come to, you know, I said, Mom, come on, I'm tired of this, you know. And Mom says, well, you're going to have to tell your father. I said, okay, I was 17 years old. I said, Dad, I'm not coming to Family Home Evening anymore. I don't like it. It doesn't seem like it's about the family. And I don't want to come anymore. And I saw a look on his face that I had never seen before and that I didn't really recognize at the time. And it didn't register until many years later when I had my own children, because it had never occurred to me that Hugh Nibley could be hurt by something I said. The interviews that we did for Faith of an Observer, our objective there, and it's a long story, and Jack Welch deserves a lot more credit for that movie than he ever got. But it started out with conversations between me and him about how we were going to, he wanted to really do something right, something special, spend $4,000 or $5,000, you know, and really do a first-class job. Well, I said we should get Sterling Van Wagenen involved, and so we got Sterling, and as film projects are wont to do, it grew beyond all proportion or reason. And, okay, let me read what I wrote here. We wanted to present Hugh Nibley as he appeared, wait. Up until that time, Hugh Nibley had gained a reputation as a writer and a lecturer, but I knew, and my co-conspirator Sterling Van Wagenen knew, another side to him, Hugh Nibley the conversationalist. We wanted to present Hugh Nibley as he appeared in more casual conversations when he would speak at length impromptu and not in a public forum. In the days of the great salons of Paris, conversation was considered a fine art. And Hugh Nibley was a wonderful conversationalist, and that's what we wanted the public to see. We knew that it was going to be a trick to capture that, and we spent a lot of time and effort to figure out how to do it. The strategy we decided on we called wildlife photography, and it consisted of several elements, many of which made a lot of people who are used to different kinds of documentary production believe that I didn't know what I was doing, which, of course, I didn't. But one thing I did know was that if you sat my father down in front of a microphone and a camera and let him loose, he would take over and he would start playing the part of a scholar and he would start lecturing, and that's what we didn't want. So here's what we did. At my request, two large sound baffles were placed as walls with a narrow crack a few inches wide between them, and the camera and cinematographer were hidden behind these walls where Dad couldn't see them. Then I asked for extra lighting placed on me and Sterling, who were going to do the interviewing. When the crew pointed out that there was no need to light us because the camera would never see us, I said, yes, but he will see us. And we want to minimize the feeling that we are on a set and he is doing a performance. Sterling and I went over in advance what we wanted to get in the interviews and worked out a plan for double teaming him. Sterling, whose intellect Dad respected, he didn't respect mine, would draw him, with good reason, would draw him out on philosophical and intellectual questions, and my job was to look for opportunities to get him to speak about aspects of his personal life and his family. Then we scheduled four-hour time blocks for the interviews. Now, Dad would arrive for interviews, as we expected he would, with prepared materials, that he would proceed to do what we also expected him to do, which was to ignore our questions, dominate the discussions and take them exactly where he wanted them to go. Now, remember what I told you about never giving a straight answer to a question? I didn't tell you that, but that's what I consider the greatest blessing that my father ever gave me, is that he never, ever in his life gave me a straight answer to a question. You know, I mean, but what he did is he, in his own way, what he kept saying is, go look it up. And he'd say, I've got a book on that. You know, well, Dad, what language is the book in? Well, you know, you'll have to learn the language first, but then you can look it up. Well, in a formal interview session, it reached its apotheosis. So what did we do? We ran him down like a pack of wolves chasing an old bull moose. We let him run for an hour or two, and eventually he'd start to get tired, and he would run out of prepared material and start wandering, and then we would move in for the kill. We also lied to him a lot. We would tell him that the camera was reloading, and he would say, now, don't film this, but, and we would assure him, none of this was going to be in the film. The camera's not rolling anyway, so yeah, tell us the real stuff. We'll get back to the interview later, and then we'd get some interesting stuff. And now, we came up with several different scripts and outlines for the movies, and they all had two things in common. One is that none of them bore any resemblance to the finished piece, and all of them included an absolute necessity that we had to go to Egypt to film. We came up with a lot of different reasons the school really needed to send us to Egypt. What Jack Welch originally conceived of as an interview piece that we should really do nicely had grown beyond all recognition. We believed that the movie would center mostly about Dad's work on that artifact of of Egyptiana known as the hypocephalus. After a week in Egypt talking about this hypocephalus in various abstruse conversations at the pyramids of Giza and in many locations in the Cairo Museum, we realized that every conversation we had assumed the listener already knew what a hypocephalus was, which was not really a safe assumption. We found that out when we were in the Cairo Museum trying to locate the collection of hypocephali, which we knew was there somewhere, but which we couldn't find. It's not a small building. There's a whole lot of Egyptian stuff there. So we told the staff we were looking for hypocephali, and they looked at us as though we were from some other country speaking a foreign language, which, of course, we were. Finally, I produced a pearl of great price and showed them the facsimile. And they nodded their heads and said, sure, they could take us to a bunch of these. And where did I get that book? And what exactly is that book? So we found the hypocephali, but we still had no definition on film to tell the audience of our film what we were talking about. We needed a shot of Hugh Nibley saying, a hypocephalus is a small circular object of papyrus or of metal or clay or papyrus placed under the head of a mummy and inscribed with hieroglyphics. Now, that's all we needed. So we set up the shot in our hotel room, and Sterling says to him, so can you tell us simply what a hypocephalus is? And he said, well, to understand that, first you must know what a hypocephalus is not. And boom, he was off for an hour, and we never got a clear statement of what a hypocephalus was. That's what it was like to interview Hugh Nibley. I'm going to tell you another story that I don't think anybody here has heard before. When I was going to receive my endowments, I was living in San Francisco, and Dad came out to take me through the Oakland Temple. And I was living at the time with a roommate from Pakistan named Ali, who had just joined the church. Now, this excited Dad a lot, and he told the two of us, he said, now by joining the church, Ali has not given up Islam. He will be a better Muslim for having joined the church, because, of course, Jesus is the greatest prophet of Islam next to Muhammad. And I was a little skeptical, and I said, Dad, you know, I've read a little of the Quran, and this whole Son of God thing doesn't really go over well with the Muslims. And his answer was a shrug, as if to say, oh, that. Well, that. These are little clues about his relationship to conflict and a lot of the polarized headbutting that we see going on in the world today. This is why I tell you this story. Now, he went on to tell my roommate, who was unclear about this whole temple business, he told him, today, Alex is going to become a haji. That's the first time I had heard that word. But Dad explained to me that it means one who had accomplished one of the great pillars of Islam and made his holy pilgrimage to Mecca and been initiated into the inner circle of his faith. Now, he gave me that title of haji with love and respect, and my roommate understood instantly what he meant. Now he knew why I was going to the temple. As you know, every war spawns its own racial and nationalistic epithets. And in World War II, Hugh Nibley watched the race of Beethoven and Goethe turn into Krauts and Jerrys, words that dripped with hatred and were used to inspire men to destroy and kill. And now haji means something else. One definition from the Urban Dictionary is offensive slang, disparaging term for Arabs, especially those of Islamic faith, first used by U.S. military forces during the early stages of 2000 Iraq invasion. Hugh Nibley believed that differences in philosophy and belief were not only inevitable, but strengthening. I think that's one thing a lot of people don't understand, is that he cared more about the people who disagreed with him than he cared about what he might have called the stupidity of their ideas. I saw him treat many ideas very harshly, but I never saw him treat a person harshly just because he had a stupid idea. Although sometimes it may have felt that way. I'm going to give you an example of that. And again, these are stories that you may not have heard before. Some of you probably know, during the 1960s and 70s, my family constituted about 20% of the Democratic Party in Utah County. And the first $5 bill I got was when Dad gave me $5 to go around and do a drop of campaign literature for a candidate. Took me several days to earn my $5 going around, you know, dropping handbills on doors. And he was politically active from always. You know, he always had the flag out on the 4th of July, and he always was ready to argue his side of the political question. But his closest friends tended to be people who were completely on a different side of the spectrum from him. And I want to give you the best example I ever saw of him in action as a politician and why he was such an enormous failure as a politician. When I was 17 years old, we had what they then called a mass meeting. It was a precinct meeting for the Democrats just south of campus. You know, not a lot more than there would be today. You know, there was me and Dad, and I was too young to vote. But I wanted to get involved, and there was Dad, and there were three or four students, and there was Sister Cullimore, whose husband had been the Republican mayor of Provo, but she was always a staunch Democrat. Now there was only one issue that we were really interested in. There was a primary race, and we had a candidate that we liked. I can't remember the race. I can't remember the candidate. That is irrelevant anymore. But we knew we really wanted this one guy, that we wanted our precinct to go for this one guy, okay? So we go in and we make the case, and I made the case saying, you know, this is the guy we want, and we feel very strongly about that. Well, all the students there had no idea what was going on. They never heard. It was a county race, you know, for something that was, you know, one of these races that BYU students didn't know anything about. So I said, oh, sure, yeah. Okay, that's cool. And I went, wow, slam dunk. We just won our first political battle. And I felt great. And then Dad said, wait a minute. Nobody spoke for the other guy. I said, Dad, we won. He says, but somebody's got to speak for the other guy. So he gave a speech for the other guy. And he did such a good job that he beat our guy. And I'm going, Dad, what is going on? Well, of course, I've forgotten who the candidate was and what the race was. But what I have not forgotten is that the process of discussion and the process of an informed democracy meant more to my father than who won. That the discussion happened was more important. And that's the lesson I took away from that. And it's one of the most valuable lessons I've ever learned in that sphere. There were actually times later on when Dad's political beliefs and the things that he said in public got him in trouble. And actually, there were threats made against our family. And this is not something that I don't think has ever been exposed in public. And they kept them quiet. But that kind of thing was going on. Dad had a dual career. One was as an apologist for the church. And the other was what Truman Madsen called being the gadfly critic of BYU and Mormon culture. Now, Remember, this is not just the guy who wrote, "No, ma'am, that's not history." This is the guy who, when he was still quite young, before he was Hugh Nibley, when he was asked to give the opening prayer, and you all know this story, right? At the commencement exercises, he gets up and he says, "Father, we stand here, garbed in the black robes of the false priesthood, to heap upon us the honors of men." He said that. That was the gadfly critic. Now, there have been good scholars that have come along to take up the torch of apologist for the church. There are scholars who read the languages pretty much as well as he did. They may not be as imaginative, but they're probably more careful in some of their scholarship. But who's ready to stand before God and invoke his presence, pointing out that the speaker himself and all his colleagues are dressed in the black robes of the false priesthood, meeting together in a festival of vanity to heap upon them the honors of men? Note that he used the first person pronoun, "we stand here." He did not exclude himself or excuse himself. He himself wore the black robe. But he was also able to see the irony in what he was doing and point it out. So, who now is ready to pick up that torch? Hugh Nibley knew a lot about vanity because he was an extraordinarily vain man. If you don't believe me, then you don't believe his own words. I remember well the conversation we had about his grandfather, C.W. Nibley, who was the presiding bishop of the church and second counselor to Heber J. Grant, and at one time reputedly the richest man in Utah. I said to Dad that I could identify with great-grandpa Nibley's driving ambition. I felt haunted by a similar drive myself, although I never made it work like Grandpa did. We're walking along at the time, and Dad turned to me and he said, "Ambition was never my problem. It was vanity." What, did you all think that those funny clothes, he wore those funny clothes because he didn't care? You missed it. He cared too much, and he knew it. His was not the peacock vanity of the Sun King strutting in silk and lace in front of the portrait artist. His was the hair shirt vanity of Thomas A. Becket. As a teenager, he had been too arrogant to help his brother wash dishes, a story my sister Zina told in her lecture on Dad. But I remember him countless times going to work in the welfare cannery, and I remember going out with him to hoe beets in the state welfare farm. Does that mean he wasn't vain? No. It means he understood his own tendency towards vanity and made a conscious decision to work against it. Sometimes he was successful, sometimes he wasn't, and the vanity showed through the rumpled second-hand hair shirts. But in my mind, a recognition of one's own vanity is the best possible definition of humility. A paradox? Yes. And not the only one that you will find in the personality of Hugh Nibley. It was Carl Gustav Jung who said, "Paradox is the essence of religion. The act of re ligere, binding again, tying back together that which was broken, to make what was fractured once more at one, is a process that always involves bringing together inimical opposites." Whether one accepts Jung's ideas or not, this notion of the importance of paradox is a useful way to understand Hugh Nibley. It was Truman Madsen again who said, "Is he a cynic and a pessimist with all kinds of negative things to say? Yes. Is he an optimist, an idealist with great hope for the future? Yes. Some say you can't get those together. He does." What are some of Hugh Nibley's other paradoxes? He was a deadly serious comic, something that got him in trouble sometimes because people thought he was joking when he was serious and thought he was serious when he was joking. He spent decades learning languages, the purpose of which is to communication, and in more languages than anyone else around. He was almost completely incapable of human communication. He was a dignified buffoon. He was an erudite ignoramus. He was an infantile sage. He was a childlike old man. He was a chauvinistic feminist. He was an ecumenical sectarian who defended his religion with great energy, but would never denigrate another person for showing similar devotion to a different sect. He was a non-dogmatic apologist. He was weak as a lily that bends in the breeze and powerful as a mighty river that carves its way through a continent. He was an emotionally detached man of pure passion. He gained a large following without ever exercising leadership. He was fearless in the face of death and trembled at terror at the most intense moments of life. The armies of the Third Reich held little terror for him because they could only kill his body, but the love of a child could wound his soul. So a laughing baby held more awe for him than battalions of SS troops and all their demonic hardware. He was a pacifist warrior. You can make your own list. You can go on. All the paradoxes that encompassed Hugh Nibley's life. I want to read, to finish, one last thing from the ending of the book. This comes after the story that is told from the transcripts of the Nuremberg trial of an SS guard who murders a Jewish family who are standing naked together, huddled together. It was a part of the book that I had to type only once and let the proofreaders deal with after that because it was simply too painful for me to proofread. I won't read that description to you. But following that, it says this. Here again is the paradox. Is it possible a picture so hideous and painful can be such a beautiful portrait of human love and dignity? As I read this, I think of what Hugh Nibley said about war and the way he lived, and I ask myself, given my choice, would I rather be the SS guard or a member of that loving family going to their death? Is it only in the face of death that we come to understand life? Is it possible to find peace in the battlefield? Is the man who sings the beautiful Der Lindenbaum in a state of war? Is it possible for a soldier to renounce war even as he obeys his officers and shoots at the enemy? Renounce war? Give no thought for what we will eat or wear? It makes no sense. But remember, his was a private war. His declaration was not political any more than was Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. The most important thing to him was not the political position on war, but a personal spiritual stance on what it all meant. He hated war and volunteered to fight. The objective was not to take himself out of the war, but to take the war out of himself. Viktor Frankl says, what we really needed in the concentration camps was a fundamental change in our attitude toward life. We had to learn ourselves, and furthermore, we had to teach the despairing men that it did not really matter what we expected of life, but rather what life expected from us. We needed to stop asking about the meaning of life and instead to think of ourselves as those who were being questioned by life daily and hourly. Our answer must consist not in talk and meditation, but in right action and right conduct. Life ultimately means taking the responsibility to find the right answer to its problems and to fulfill the tasks which it constantly sets for each individual. And the final quote from Hugh Nibley himself, I remember the dream I had in the foxhole outside Carentan, the one where Dave Bernay woke me up, and I felt so happy because it was just a dream and I hadn't actually committed the terrible crime I had dreamed about. There I was in the middle of a battle, and I was completely happy. It came to me very strongly. I shouldn't be happy in this circumstance. But it's not what happens to you that matters. It's not what becomes of you. It's what you become that's important.